onto Yorkville, South Carolina, then across the Broad River, then over the Saladin River, then to Cokesbury. Astonishingly enough, as he moved through a war-torn South Carolina, here, in the lengthy shadow of John Calhoun, the public affection for him was as deep as ever, with buoyant crowds turning out at every stop to cheer him on and to wish him well. He pledged not to leave Confederate soil as long as there were men in uniform willing to fight for the cause. But in now rejecting surrender, he had assured his own isolation and condemnation. He pressed on. By May 2nd, there were far fewer men in his caravan, although there were still 3,000 troops providing him protection. Now came another Rubicon. He huddled privately with his military aides to make one last appeal to those loyal cabinet assistants and military men remaining by his side. It was his last council of war. Remarkably, Davis's passion had not been dimmed by the events of the last 30 days. He believed that if they could somehow weather the temporary panic, the people would once again rally. One more time, and with a straight face, he gave it everything he had, and on one level, he was not unpersuasive. He appealed eloquently to every sentiment and reminiscences that might move a Southern soldier, noted one of his aides. But at this stage, he displayed more fervor than judgment, and at this point, it was too late. The aides shook their heads sadly. Their rejection, though couched in soft terms, they were still loyal, was blunt. They agreed with Lee. The country was exhausted. Any attempt to prolong the war with partisan conflict would be a cruel injustice. It was time. Davis rose unsteadily to his feet, curiously feeble, almost tottering. For the first time in the war, he was a thoroughly shaken man. "Then all is lost," he muttered. Yet Davis, his face lined and lean and intent, refused to quit. In his final flight, he remained dignified, although these were high-strung moments. He bravely sought to put the best face on it. "Dear wife," he wrote to Verena, "this is not the fate to which I invited you when the future was rose-colored to us both. But I know you will bear it even better than myself, and that, for the two of us, I alone will ever look back reproachfully on my past career." On May 3, Davis's dwindling procession of horses and carriages crossed the Savannah River into Georgia. Accusing him, falsely, of complicity in Lincoln's assassination, the Union had put a $100,000 price tag on his head. The search for Davis intensified. Through yet another downpour, he continued to flee. On May 10, it happened, the very thing Lincoln wanted never to occur. In Georgia, amid talk of hanging and treason, Jefferson Davis was captured by Union cavalry, who taunted him mercilessly. In the wake of Lincoln's death, one of the now departed president's greatest fears had come to pass. The last thin membrane of civility, instead of being strengthened, had seemingly evaporated. To Davis's face, the troops mocked him, like a common criminal or a babbling vulgar demagogue. If this was a harbinger of things to come, it was an ominous sign. But there was little doubting that the last vestige of the Confederate government had now ceased to exist. That very same day, United States President Andrew Johnson issued a formal proclamation. "The armed resistance to the authority of this government," he declared, "may be regarded as virtually at an end." But for all to be at an end, there was one more boil to be lanced: the capture of the assassin, John Wilkes Booth. Since Easter Sunday, April 16, an unprecedented manhunt had been underway for Booth and his accomplices. In Washington, Stanton and Gideon Welles worked furiously, pressing every bit of the War and Navy Department's resources and personnel into a round-the-clock search. Soldiers, sailors, cavalry troops, civilians, marshals, the police, detectives, and Secret Service agents all joined the fray. "Let the stain of innocent blood be removed from the land by the arrest and punishment of the murderers," one War Department poster declared. Rest neither night nor day until it be accomplished. Now every vessel in the Chesapeake Bay, the Potomac River, and the Virginia shores was scoured. Anyone remotely suspicious was picked up. Even Booth's relatives and his brother, Junius, were fair game. In the days that followed, a reward of $50,000 was placed on Booth's head, lesser amounts for his accomplices. It was an impressive display of force, and mass arrests were soon widespread. In short order, the prisons were overflowing with hundreds of suspects, an erratic array of potential witnesses and possible conspirators. Most were held for several weeks, usually without any charges. Literally anyone who had the slightest contact with Booth was tossed in jail either as a witness or a co-conspirator, including friends, employees at Ford's Theater, and dozens of hapless souls vaguely matching Booth's description who were randomly picked up in cities across the Union. The belief, widely held, was that the South was responsible. "All circumstances signify," Stanton wrote in one telegram, "a plot laid in Richmond before the capture of that city." The chase mounted. By week's end, the extensive search had borne some initial results. Lewis Powell, George Atzerodt, and a host of other more tangential Booth accomplices, Samuel B. Arnold, Michael O'Loughlin, and Edmund Spangler, were all seized and locked in double irons in the hold of an ironclad ship anchored in the Potomac. But, for all the manpower being dedicated to their capture, the dart had not yet quite hit its target. Booth and another erstwhile accomplice, Davy Harold, remained at large. From the perspective of today's world, an era of instantaneous communication, modems, faxes, telephones, and email shuffling information from one corner of the globe to another in a matter of nanoseconds, Booth's escape is almost impossible to fathom. But in the beginning, it was almost astonishingly simple. After shooting Lincoln, Booth raced off from the back alley of Ford's Theater, galloping at a full clip toward the Navy Yard Bridge, 20 minutes away. His destination was the back country of southern Maryland. At the Navy Yard Bridge, a sentry questioned him closely. Remarkably, Booth was able to move considerably faster than the actual news of Lincoln's shooting. Cleverly, Booth provided the sentry with his real name. He was, after all, one of the best-known actors in the world. This did the trick. He was allowed to cross the Anacostia River, the eastern branch of the Potomac. In darkness, he thundered off. Davy Harold also escaped across the bridge, soon catching up to Booth. The pair rode at high speed for the Mason-Dixon line. 8 miles south of Washington, they paused at Mary Surratt's Tavern in Surrattsville, where they picked up 2 Spencer carbines, ammunition, and field glasses that had earlier been squirreled away. Booth told the innkeeper, a Confederate sympathizer, "I am pretty certain that we have assassinated the President and Secretary Seward." Again into the night they went. It began to rain. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Booth and Harold arrived at the farm of Dr. Samuel Mudd in Charles County, Maryland. Mudd was another sympathizer to the rebellion. Booth was tired, wet, and in pain, his leg having been broken by his 12-foot jump from the presidential box. Mudd set Booth's injured leg, fashioned a pair of crude crutches for him, and gave him shelter. The actor then slept for most of the day in an upstairs bedroom, his face buried in his pillow against the wall. This time, he apparently said nothing about the assassination. Dr. Mudd was totally in the dark. But as Booth slept, thousands of Union troops were now crawling over the countryside. A detachment of cavalry came close enough that an unnerved Mudd insisted the fugitives leave his property. They raced off, still out of reach of Union authorities. Mudd would not be so lucky. Within 6 days, detectives would discover Booth's slit-riding boot at his house. Mudd was summarily arrested. But his bad luck would also be Booth's. It was from Mudd that they would learn that Booth was injured. For Stanton's pursuers, this little piece of information was a godsend. They now concentrated their search on lame man sightings. But the lame man was nowhere to be found. The fugitives were hiding out amid the dreary thickets and insects of the Zakiya Swamp, hoping to cross the Potomac River into Virginia. Normally, this would have been an easy matter. The area was a stronghold of a notoriously pro-Southern population, which in past days would have readily ferried them across. But an ever-growing number of Union troops was combing the countryside and manhandling local residents in the search for information. Frenetic. "I have too great a soul to die like a criminal," Booth explained. He and Harold finally hooked up with a Confederate agent, Thomas Jones, who took care of them for several days. Booth was exceedingly pale, and his face bore evident traces of suffering. The agent fed them ham and bread and butter. Now, listening to the scratch of his own breath, his mouth tightened and eyes pinched and dreadfully cold, Booth could hear the swishing of feet through the marsh and the rattling of soldiers' sabers looking for them. On April 21, as ribbons of smoky light filtered off the river and birds beat their wings against the water, there was a break. On a narrow beach where a stream flowed into the Potomac, Booth and Harold boarded a little 12-foot rowboat. Taking advantage of the momentary lull, they slipped the boat into the water. On their first attempt, however, they failed to catch the right tide and were swept upriver, landing back on the Maryland shore. "I am here in despair," Booth exclaimed. Again they hid. The next evening, they tried again. "Tonight," he noted, "I try to escape these bloodhounds once more." This time the current held. It took them several hours to cross the Potomac in darkness. Finally, they were in the friendlier territory of Virginia. But even here, help was scarce. Otherwise, loyal Confederates were worried about the consequences of housing such a prominent fugitive. Filthy and unshaven, Booth had nowhere to go. The actor resorted to brute force and intimidation. On April 23, he and Harold bullied their way into the one-room cabin of a freeborn black. From there, the next day, they arranged to be ferried on the Rappahannock River over to Port Royal on the opposite shore. Exhausted, their nerves frayed, they sought refuge at Richard Garrett's tobacco farm. This time, Booth used the alias of James W. Boyd to match the initials visibly tattooed on his hand. The farm was so isolated that news of the assassination had not yet reached it. Once more, this proved to be Booth's good luck. He began to plot his final escape to Mexico. But the luck soon ran out. On Tuesday, April 25, to be precise. Late that afternoon, a detachment of Union cavalry passed right by the Garrett farm. Booth and Harold quickly hid in the woods, weapons at the ready. They successfully eluded the Unionists, but in doing so fatally alarmed their hosts. The strange reaction of their guests deeply rattled the Garrett family. "I'm afraid these men will get us into trouble," the father whispered to his two sons. "You had better watch them tonight." He angrily told Booth and Harold that they were no longer welcome. The two anxiously pleaded with him. Could they at least buy his horses? "No," Garrett said. "Well, one more night," they asked. Eventually, Garrett relented. They could spend the evening, but it would have to be in the tobacco barn. Around midnight, Union troops nearby got a tip as to where Booth was staying. The dragnet quickly closed in. In darkness, by 2 a.m. Wednesday morning, a heavily armed search party had dismounted and was quietly deployed around the Garrett farm. Garrett's dog suddenly began to bark. When a stunned Richard Garrett opened the front door, in his nightshirt, he found a pistol shoved in his face. "Where are they?" the Union officer demanded. Garrett stammered, unsure of what to do but refusing to give them up. Eventually, the son mutely pointed. Then he blurted out, "They're in there." There, of course, was the barn, about 50 yards from the house. Within moments, it was surrounded. "You men better come out here," the Union officer shouted, pounding on the double door with the butt of his revolver. Harold came out with his hands up, but Booth refused. Cradling his three pistols and a carbine, he asked for a sporting chance to shoot it out. The Union officer denied his request. "Well, my brave boys," Booth then shouted defiantly, "then you can prepare a stretcher for me." It was at that point that one of the Union officers twisted some hay into a rope, lit it, and threw it through a slat in the back of the barn. It began to burn, exploding into flames. It is a paradox that during the tumult of the Civil War, the theater flourished. The deplorable circumstances of the time, the ferment, the controversy and death, all seemed to create a yearning for entertainment. Consider Lincoln's theater-going schedule in February and March of 1864 alone. In wartime, he had already seen such second-rate productions as Leah, featuring Avonia Jones, the performance of Barney Williams, the Irish comedian, the middlebrow The Marble Heart, starring John Wilkes Booth, and James Hackett in the far better Henry IV. Even while the war raged, during this, one of its most precarious periods, he somehow squeezed in time to watch a rash of Shakespeare's plays, Richard III, Julius Caesar, The Merchant of Venice, and Hamlet. Such widespread interest in the theater was, of course, good news for the Booth family, considered the first family of American entertainment. And the widespread interest of the first citizen of the Union would prove to be something else entirely for the youngest Booth son, John Wilkes. Even for the times, the affinity between John Wilkes Booth and Abraham Lincoln stands as one of the most curious relationships imaginable. For one thing, too often forgotten in the wake of later events is that Lincoln, the war president, was as loathed in his day as he was loved. He may well have been the most reviled president of all. Ironically, Booth the entertainer was far more universally popular among those who knew him, enjoying enthusiastic plaudits and widespread fame in the North as well as the South. One of his admirers, of course, was President Lincoln. And it is here that the tale darkens. John Wilkes Booth was born in 1838 in Bel Air, Maryland, the ninth son of 10 children, and a bastard at that. His father, Junius Brutus Booth, an alcoholic and mentally unstable rogue, had two wives, one back in England and one in America. But the Booth family had few peers when it came to the theater. Talented and quirky, Booth's father was considered the greatest Shakespearean performer of his generation. John Wilkes' brother, Edwin, was even better, and is regarded by many to be among the finest actors in America of all time. Lincoln saw him in four plays during a mere 8 weeks in 1864. His brother, Junius Booth, Jr., was a successful producer, and his brother-in-law was a noted comedian. A striking, self-centered young man, Booth was his mother's darling. He studied in several private academies around Baltimore, where he made his stage debut at the age of 17. By then, he was a serious athlete, too, an expert horseman, a fencer, and a crack pistol shot. His earliest performances were coarse and, some said, less charitably, even comical. But he quickly improved, taking on a slew of demanding roles. Soon, he established himself as a rising young Shakespearean star, especially in the South. He had just the right appearance. A devastatingly handsome man, with dark wavy hair, enticing hazel eyes, and a neatly cropped full mustache, he had an unmistakably alluring look about him, what the Italians might call a dolce sera, sweet face, and even a touch of Oriental mystery. Women found him irresistible, and so did his audiences, who were drawn to his exotic demeanor, his flamboyant gestures, and his ranting eloquence. They also took to his impassioned athletic style of acting. Though he was only 5'8", his bearing was impressively erect and his chest broad, giving the impression of virility and masculinity, which was no doubt helped by the difficult leaps that he used to announce his first appearance on stage, the dashing duels so true to life that real blood was drawn, and the torrid love scenes with his stage paramours. The true challenge for an actor in the 1850s was then, as now, Shakespearean roles, and enchanted Dixie audiences flocked to his captivating portrayals of Hamlet as the eccentrically tortured prince and Richard III as the sinister fiend. Theater critics were rare back then, but Booth was subjected to some harsh criticism. While one termed him an actor of genius and talent, another lashed into him as crude, raw, given to boisterous declamation. The criticism stung deeply. Still, as is often the case, popular acclaim ruled, and audiences packed his performances, making him one of the most prized actors in the country. By 1864, he was earning $20,000 a year, double what Robert E. Lee was making as General-in-Chief of the Confederate armies, infinitely more than the rebel privates who had just been given a raise to $18 a month, and considerably more than the average annual earnings for a working family in the North, which was $297. He was also one of history's great scamps. Southerners loved his vivacity, his passion, his talent as a raconteur, his ability to hold a good stiff drink. More often than not, he was irritable, moody, prone to depressions, and just as prone to getting drunk. Anything, he once said, to drive away the blues. And his erotic exploits were the stuff of Hollywood legend. He was notoriously available to assorted mistresses, lovers, adoring young virgins, actresses, prostitutes, and theater groupies all over. One young lover, scorned in Albany, stabbed herself in a fit of distress. At another point, while betrothed to the daughter of a prominent senator, the ever-faithful Lucy Hale of New Hampshire, he was regularly slipping naked into the bed of his mistress, Ella Turner, a lusty diminutive redhead. At the same time, there were at least four other women whose skirts he evidently sought. Upon his death, photographs of each of them would be found on his person. Yet all this was not out of pure lasciviousness. He also used his good looks and sexual appetite as pawns in a much larger stage on which he was determined to play the leading role. That, of course, came later. While he was from Maryland, technically the dividing line between North and South, like many other Marylanders, he fancied himself a member of the Southern gentry. And where his older brother Edwin harbored deep and abiding Union tendencies, voting for Lincoln twice, Booth held militant Confederate sympathies. "If the North conquers us," he grumbled to his sister Asia, "it will be by numbers only." "If the North conquer us," his sister replied, astonished. "But we are of the North." "Not I," Booth scornfully responded. "So help me God, my soul, life, and possessions are for the South." Apparently so. When the war broke out, he did little to conceal his sympathies for the Confederacy. He was a staunch supporter of slavery, in his words, one of the greatest blessings, both for themselves and us, and his contempt for Lincoln was rabid and untamed. He was offended by Lincoln's appearance, his pedigree, his coarse low jokes and anecdotes, his vulgar similes, and his frivolity. He was also offended by Lincoln's war efforts, seeing him as the vilest of tyrants. Soon, hate became preoccupation. Preoccupation became fixation. Then fixation became fanaticism. He worried that the Northern president would overthrow the Constitution and that he would be made a king in America, as he once told his brother. And that was what he eventually would become determined to prevent. Lincoln's re-election in 1864 drove Booth to the breaking point, until he hatched a plan to kidnap the tyrant in the White House and take him to Richmond, to be held for the ransom of the thousands of rebel prisoners now withering away in Union jails. To carry out his plan, he recruited a band of misfits, dregs, and old friends drawn from Washington and Baltimore. Nonetheless, given the circumstances, there was a sort of crude logic to his scheme, and to the men he chose. There were his boyhood chums, Samuel Arnold and Michael O'Loughlin. There was baby-faced John Surratt, who had once studied to be a Catholic priest and who had first-hand knowledge of the Confederate underground active in southern Maryland. There was George Atzerodt, the German immigrant, who ferried Confederate spies across the Potomac and knew all the creeks and inlets. There was the hulking Lewis Powell, who had once ridden with Mosby, or so he said, and could provide brawn and violence. And there was young Davy Harold, dim-witted and immature, whose principal value oddly seemed to be that he clerked in the drugstore where Lincoln bought his medicines, but who also knew the poorly mapped roads below Washington well. The circumstances surrounding Booth's exploits are among the murkiest of the war, and impossible to confirm or explain with total certitude. Almost unique in Civil War America, he moved with unfettered freedom across Confederate and Union lines alike. His traveling pass was, he boasted, signed by General Grant. Shuttling from Montgomery, Columbus, and Richmond in the South, to Albany, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, and New York in the North. At various points, he conferred with rebel agents in Maryland, then Boston, then Canada, out of which he eventually came up with a scheme to abduct Lincoln and spirit him behind Confederate lines in Virginia. Did the Confederate government know about any of this, or authorize or approve of any of Booth's plans? Like all great mysteries, this one appears destined to remain unsolved. But it is certainly tinged with conspiracy, the only question being, conspiracy with whom? Most historians dismiss any involvement of the Confederate leadership, including Jefferson Davis, although newer scholarship has reopened the debate. But whatever Davis's role, which does seem unlikely, it is clear that at the lower levels of the Confederate Secret Service, the abduction of the Union president was under consideration. In fact, Booth's scheme was very much like one which Confederate authorities permitted Thomas Conrad to attempt in the fall of 1864. And it wouldn't have been the first time that a Secret Service had carried out plans of which its higher-ups would never have approved. Whatever the case, throughout these dismal months of fall 1864, Booth and his fellow conspirators hunched over maps, explored roads, and examined drawings of the White House. They trailed the president on his carriage and horseback rides, as well as on his frequent theater visits, invariably kept at an annoying distance by the heavy cavalry guard or private detail watching the chief executive. The plotting continued. Booth had special riding boots made, complete with pockets sewn into them that enabled him to carry letters and illicit communiques. That winter, he went a step further, giving up acting altogether so he could devote his energies full-time to his plans. His meetings often took place at the Surratt Tavern, owned by Surratt's mother, Mary, or at her Washington boarding house on H Street. Over the ensuing months, he shelled out more than a hefty $10,000 to pay for supplies, weapons, chloroform, ropes, a boat, horses, a wagon, a stable behind Ford's, and meals, drink, and lodging for the plotters. He feted the assassins with oysters and champagne. Finally, he booked a room at the National Hotel by Ford's Theater. This was to be his personal base of operations. All was now ready. His first plan, to capture Lincoln while he was attending Ford's and bind and lower him from the box, fizzled as a result of its own tenuousness. It was almost laughable in its conception. A second, far more practical plan also went awry. On March 17, 1865, he had planned to capture Lincoln while he was riding his carriage on the outskirts of the city. At the last moment, Lincoln changed itineraries, electing to remain in the city and review a regiment of returning Indiana volunteers. Ironically, that day Lincoln himself was at the National Hotel, accepting a captured Confederate flag. For Booth, it was a debacle, and mortifying. But more chances would present themselves. He persevered. His first real opportunity for action had actually come on March 4, Inauguration Day, which he had attended with Senator Hale's daughter, Lucy. It was around this time when the thought struck him that rather than abduct the president, he could simply assassinate him. Standing there outside the Capitol Rotunda, in plain sight of Lincoln, he told himself, "What an excellent chance I had to kill the president." After these lost opportunities, O'Loughlin, Surratt, and Arnold broke away, but the other three remained. That was more than enough for Booth, as his new plan metastasized and slowly evolved. For Booth, these were difficult days. The waning of the fortunes of the Confederacy drove him into deep depression. So did some questionable investments that lost him money. He began drinking heavily. And, having always had trouble sifting illusion from reality, he now began concocting a fervid new role for himself, not as Confederate agent, but as something much grander, a kind of messianic reincarnation, a second coming of the larger-than-life characters whose lines he had so passionately uttered, William Tell and, more often than not, the family hero, Brutus, who brought down the tyrannical Caesar. Just as he had stood there in 1859 at the hanging of John Brown, the madman who helped instigate the war, he was also there at Lincoln's White House address on the rainy evening of April 11, as the war was coming to a close. when the president recommended suffrage for educated blacks, Booth now snarled, "By God, I'll put him through." He even urged Lewis Powell to shoot Lincoln on the spot. Powell refused. At this point, in disgust, he muttered, "That is the last speech he will ever make." No more accurate prediction had ever been delivered. The time had finally come. After April 11, he concluded, "Our cause being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done." 3 days later, on April 14, he learned that Lincoln would be attending Ford's. It was then that he decided to implement his plan. Was he now dwelling solely in hate-filled fantasy? Consider this. For all the harebrained scheming, and despite his decidedly amateur co-conspirators, what is so remarkable is how close he actually came not simply to killing Lincoln, but to decapitating the executive trio of the United States. The weakest link in his plan turned out to be George Atzerodt, who only at the last second begged off. As would later be revealed, he had said, "I enlisted to abduct the President of the United States, not to kill him." Only history can contemplate the enormous consequences had Andrew Johnson been successfully murdered as well, or if the still largely untested presidential transition process had gone awry. But that is small consolation. For on April 14, at 10:14 that night, when Booth pulled the trigger of his Derringer, he forever mingled his fate with Abraham Lincoln's, and with the history of the nation. And like many a fanatic, he jeopardized what he had hoped to save, placing the enormous stock of the Union government's goodwill engendered toward the South by the touching surrender at Appomattox at total risk. Notably, that seemed as true on April 26 when the barn he was hiding in at the Garrett farm went up in flames and lit the darkness, as it does now. "Let me die bravely," Booth had written just days earlier. It was now around 4:30 a.m. Union troopers, peering through the gaps between the barn boards, could see Booth hobbling about with a carbine in one hand and a revolver in another. "He was as beautiful as a statue of a Greek god," recalled the young Richard Garrett, "and as calm in that awful hour." As Booth made his move toward the barn door, a shot rang out. Booth fell to the ground, face first, then pitched over. He was still breathing, but barely. The bullet had cut through the right side of the assassin's neck, severing his spinal cord. He was paralyzed and dying. In the half-light that precedes dawn, Union soldiers dragged him away from the burning barn and placed him on the porch of the Garrett farmhouse. Bleeding, dirty and sweaty, his breath shallow, he hovered in and out of consciousness, at one point begging his captors to kill him. They refused. They wanted the reward and vengeance. A doctor arrived from nearby Port Royal, but announced there was nothing he could do. The wound was mortal. Slowly, the sun began to climb into the sky, signaling a new day. By happenstance, it was Booth's birthday. He was 27. It was all morbid and melodramatic and quite real. And in a last bit of telling symbolism, while Lincoln lasted a full 9 hours and 7 minutes with a bullet in his head, Booth survived only 2.5 hours. Just before he died, he asked to see his hands. "Useless," his purple lips muttered, "useless." Whatever he meant by this, his paralyzed hands, the assassination, the rebellion, we will never know. At another point, he had moaned, "Tell my mother that I did it for my country, that I die for my country." This final statement contained perhaps the most pungent note. Booth had always clamored for fame. As he once said to a friend, he would make his name remembered by succeeding generations. In all his infamy, that was certainly proven true. But there was another, far more profound truth that, in his growing rage and madness, Booth had somehow gleaned. About a week earlier, while on the run, Booth had ripped out several pages from his pocket diary and written a long, rambling explanation of his actions. Much of what he said was labored, contrived, dissembling, or inflated. But not this one observation. The country is not, April 1865, what it was. Part 4, Late Spring, 1865. Chapter 8. Reconciliation. As long lines of refugees crept home, news of the war's end spread rapidly across the northern capital, across the Union, across America. In the north, it raced instantaneously over the vast web of telegraph wires from city to city. In the south, it moved far more slowly, often crawling from town to town, from mouth to mouth. But move it did. And what now? These final days turn not on the issues of battle or the fibers of war, but on the sinews of politics and justice. But foremost was the question of healing. The North had gambled with total war and won. The South had wagered all and lost. The Confederacy was no more. Could these two distant sides now reconcile themselves to each other? Even as the guns of war grew still, emotions seethed. The hate, of course, was the most perilous. In the South, it was perhaps understandable, but it did not augur well for the future. One Southern innkeeper told a journalist that Yankees had murdered his soldier sons, torched his house, and taken his slaves. "They left me one inestimable privilege, to hate 'em," he drawled. "I get up at 4:30 in the morning and sit up till 12 at night to hate 'em." Swore another Southerner, a young planter, "I have vowed that if I should have children, the first ingredient of the first principle of their education shall be uncompromising hatred and contempt of the Yankee." To which he added, "Day by day and hour by hour does the deep-seated enmity I have always had for the accursed Yankee nation increase and burn higher." A Confederate matron, Henrietta Lee, whose house and 7 outbuildings had been set aflame by the Union, made her venomous feelings known directly to the federal commander. "Hyena-like, you have torn my heart to pieces. Demon-like, you have done it without pretext of revenge. Your name will stand on history's pages as the hunter of weak women and innocent children, the hunter to destroy defenseless villages and torture afresh the agonized hearts of widows." Said another woman quite simply, "Oh, how I hate the Yankees! I could trample on their dead bodies and spit on them." The hatred, the bitterness, the vehemence would not dissipate overnight, nor would the despondency. Whatever the grievous moral sins of the South, the economic damage and annihilation of Southern property was largely without parallel. At least 2/3 of assessed Southern wealth had vanished during the war. Neither the nobility in the French Revolution, nor the Russian serf owners in 1861, nor the slave owners of the West Indies in the 19th century, nor, for that matter, the owners of businesses nationalized by 20th century socialists in Western Europe, had to face such an overwhelming loss of property as did the slave owners of the South. To many Southerners, it seemed that not since Roman times had an entire people lost so much. Most daunting of all was perhaps not the physical or economic damage, but the emotional wreckage. Mary Chestnut, the astute, articulate Southern hostess and socialite, her home ransacked, and she reduced to selling butter and eggs with her faithful maid to earn a little money, $12 a month, expressed this cascade of sentiments eloquently in her diary. "The deep waters are closing over us," she wrote. "We are scattered, stunned, the remnant of heart left alive with us." Elsewhere she penned, "A feeling of sadness hovers over me now, day and night, that no words can express. They are everywhere, these Yankees, like red ants, like the locusts and frogs which were the plagues of Egypt." She later continued, "I do not think I ever did as much weeping, or as bitter, in the same space of time. I let myself go." And again, "I cried with a will. I thought I was very ill. They thought I was dying." And finally, she added, "I wish I had died." Nor was she alone. Listen to the suicidal words of the widow Mary Vaughn, her father, her infant son, and her husband, now all dead. Writing from her plantation home, ironically named Sunnyside, she said, "I have but one wish, and that is to die." "Why?" she asked. Will not God smite me too? I have not read my Bible since Charlie, my husband, died, she confided. My tears and feelings seem frozen. I feel but one thing. I am alone, utterly desolate. By late April 1865, then, the Confederate world heard only faint echoes of the lively, hot-headed, hot-blooded, vivacious, bustling antebellum era. The streets were filled with barefoot survivors ambling despondently, women sorting through piles of rubble, pale men gathering to exchange meager goods. The enormity of the Reconstruction challenge was staggering. Powerful plantation owners were now without homes. Prosperous bankers were now beggars. Hordes of hungry young children, roaming the alleyways, were now dirt-smudged orphans. Robust generals, hobbling on homemade crutches, were now cripples. Rigidly proud Southern ladies, now humbly lined up for federal rations. For far too many, the faculty of wonder had been dulled. Enthusiasm had given way to endurance, excitement to bankruptcy. Death was glumly familiar, and sorrow all too tragically numbed. It was there to see in every direction. Railroad service had largely come to a halt. Commerce was virtually non-existent. Our people haven't any money, sir. Civil authority was scant. Refugees packed the roads, the saddest sight of all. Psychologists who have studied the impact of natural disasters on society, earthquakes, hurricanes, fires, floods, speak bleakly of a broad and terrible social numbing that occurs, afflicting not simply those directly affected, but whole generations living in a disaster's merciless wake. It is impossible to measure the full-fledged effect of the war on the Southern psyche. But this much can be said. In these waning days, Southerners were incoherent with grief, their land diseased and without a cure. So great was the sense of gloom across the battle-scarred South that a Northern journalist, eyeing the defeated Southerners, penned the following glum observation. They expected nothing, were prepared for the worst, would have been thankful for anything. They asked no terms, made no conditions. They were defeated and helpless. They submitted. By contrast, in the North, the picture was mixed. For many, they or their loved ones had cheated death and survived. The war had been fought, a great victory had been won, the Union had been preserved, and they were rejoicing high on a cloud of euphoria, which was both understandable and ominous. Ominous because their celebration was the South's heartbreak, and the two were largely irreconcilable. And across much of the North, too, anger and rage also ruled. All over the Union, wrote Margaret Leach, the noted historian, a hoarse cry of vengeance sounded a discordant requiem for Lincoln. Discordant it was. It was one thing to keep the country together by the force of arms, quite another, as Lincoln had so fervently recognized, to bind up its wounds. Was this to be, then, only a temporary reconciliation, with Lincoln's vision ready to become unglued and undone at the next opportunity? Hate, despondency, and vengeance now loomed like a hydra for America. They could have steeped the country in rancor and chaos, and destroyed any possibility of true union. But they did not. Over 620,000 lay dead, 1/12 of the North, and an astonishing 1/5 of the South. All told, it was the most battle deaths in the country's history, as great as in all of the nation's other wars combined. Yet, remarkably, as the North and South, leaders and citizens alike, struggled to adjust to the new order, they rose to the occasion. Somehow, through the blurry, snarling mists of war, and for a brief shining moment before the bitter taste of Reconstruction, civility and restraint ruled long enough to avert disarray and turmoil. For Unionists and Confederates both, there was everywhere a notion that somehow they had lived through history, and everyone wanted a piece of it, literally. The apple tree under whose shade Lee had rested before surrendering at Appomattox was quickly sliced up, hacked away at, and peeled off by enterprising soldiers and, within hours, had been stripped clean, until all that was left was a gigantic hole every little piece of bark and wood taken to be enshrined as an heirloom, passing from one generation to the next. As soon as Lee and Grant had left the Wilmer McLean house, that too was stripped. Lee's table, Grant's table, the brass candlesticks, a stone inkstand, a child's doll, the upholstery from the chairs and sofas cut to ribbons, and the cane-bottomed seats sliced into strips, each item taken for posterity. At the passing of the armies, bits of the Confederate battle flags were ripped, lovingly folded, and carefully stowed away in pants pockets to become treasured reminders for the ages. And so, too, the Peterson house, where Lincoln died, again stripped clean, the very wallpaper peeled off the walls. Even the scaffold on which the Confederate assassination conspirators were later hanged was cut up for souvenirs. And in countless parlors and porches, battle stories would be told and retold to the merry rumble of children's and grandchildren's voices, or amid the scent of pine and wax candles and steaming hot cider on a cold winter's day, until the feeling prevailed that everyone of consequence had been there, had valiantly climbed those hills, dodged those bullets, survived those wounds. Indeed, everywhere across America there was an awareness of endings and beginnings. The South had to struggle with its destitution. The North had to wrestle with its grief. The country as a whole had to ponder, what next? In the North, it began with mourning. In New York, on 550 Broadway, precisely at 7:22 a.m. on April 15, the clock at Tiffany's and Company, held aloft by a huge wooden atlas, had come to a halt. This was no doubt fitting, for, as was well known, Charles Lewis Tiffany greatly esteemed Lincoln. Across town, in Brooklyn, Walt Whitman was at home when he heard the news. His mother prepared their breakfast, as usual, but it was left untouched and unnoticed, as were the rest of the day's meals. He sipped a half cup of coffee, and after pushing his plate of food away, he scoured every newspaper, silently passing them back and forth with his mother. Then he crossed over to Manhattan, and to darkening skies and driving rain, trudged up Broadway, past shuttered stores hung with black. Lincoln's death, he wrote in his notebook, black, black, black. As you look toward the sky, long, broad, black, like great serpents. 4 days later, farther north, in Concord, Massachusetts, all business and labor was suspended between 11 and 2 o'clock, as the townspeople moodily gathered in the local Unitarian church. Music was played and selections from the scriptures and prayers were read. Then Ralph Waldo Emerson gave a somber address. Rarely was a man so fitted to events, he said of Lincoln, about whom he had often had severe reservations. Only Washington can compare with him in the future. To the South, it would take a full 7 days for Mary Chestnut to receive the news of the assassination, which arrived for her husband on April 22 in a sealed envelope by secret dispatch. She opened it. "It is simply maddening, all this," she wrote. A friend of hers saw it differently. "See if they don't take vengeance on us," she warned, "now that we are ruined and cannot repel them any longer." Another friend quipped defiantly, "I call that a warning to tyrants." By then, though, Lincoln had been eulogized, his funeral had been held, and his remains had begun the long journey home to Springfield. On Wednesday, April 19, Lincoln's casket spent its final hours lying in state in the east room of the White House. Outside, the sun beamed, and a gentle breeze caressed the sky. Inside, black was everywhere, on the chandeliers, on the ornate gilt frames of the mirrors, in the adjoining rooms, even on the steps. The east room itself was hushed, dim, somber. Lincoln's coffin rested on a flower-covered catafalque, a bed of roses at his feet. Even in death, his gangly frame filled the open casket. His head rested on a white pillow, a queer smile fixed on his lips. At 11 that morning, the services began. 600 people crowded into the room. All of official Washington was here. President Johnson and his cabinet, Senator Sumner and his congressional colleagues, Justice Chase and the Supreme Court, generals and the diplomatic corps, Lincoln's personal cavalry and bodyguards, his personal aides and his sons, Robert and Ted, standing at the foot of the coffin, grief-stricken. At the other end, General Grant sat, alone, his numbed gaze fixed on a cross of lilies, a black mourning crepe wound around his arm. In full view, he wept, later maintaining that this was the saddest day of his life. For his part, President Johnson stood erect and quiet, facing the middle, his hands crossed on his breast. Four ministers spoke and delivered their prayers. Then the casket was closed. With machine-like efficiency, 12 veteran corps sergeants lifted the coffin, carrying it out into the funeral car, into the sunlit day, into the dirge of bells tolling and bands playing for the dead. In slow time, the funeral procession started up Pennsylvania Avenue. With a detachment of black troops in the lead, it moved, in careful, measured, rhythmic steps. Lincoln's empty boots sat eerily in the stirrups of his riderless horse, which followed behind, as though ready to join his master in the afterlife, while columns of mourners trudged to the steady, muffled roll of drums. Arms reversed, battalions and regiments were next. Soon the lines curved and swelled like the great blue sky, with wounded soldiers, torn and bandaged men, marching along. Behind them came a cortege of black citizens, stretching from curb to curb in neatly ordered lines of 40. 4,000 of them all told, in dark coats and shiny white gloves, clasping hands and quiet as they strode along. In their wake, heavy artillery rumbled. When the procession reached the Capitol, the sergeants gently lifted Lincoln into the rotunda, where he lay in state on another catafalque. All the oil paintings and bright white statues were covered, except for the figure of George Washington, on which a simple black sash was tied. During that day, and the next, thousands of people filed through to get one last glimpse and pay their last respects. Noah Brooks recorded, "Like black atoms moving over a sheet of gray, the slow-moving mourners crept silently in two dark lines across the pavement of the rotunda." The next day, April 21, a 9-car funeral train bore Lincoln from the Capitol. It would make a journey of 14 days and 1,662 miles back to Illinois, retracing the route that a freshly elected United States president had taken to Washington 4 years earlier. The train crept forward, to ringing bells and through the soft spring landscape. All along the route, people gathered, watching in stunned silence as the train rolled by under the velvety sky. In Philadelphia, Lincoln's coffin was placed in Independence Hall, where a double line of mourners stretched 3 miles deep. Among them was former President Buchanan, just one day shy of his 70th birthday. Ignoring his advancing age, he had driven his buggy all the way from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to see the fallen president. In New York City, the procession continued for 4 hours. 85,000 mourners accompanied the funeral hearse through the streets beneath a thicket of signs. "Mankind has lost a friend, and we a president," one sign said. Another read, "In sorrowing tears, the nation's grief is spent." A tearful Walt Whitman would never forget this moment. From that time on, every spring, with its lilacs blooming and the season blossoming, would remind him of the coffin passing in the street. 6-year-old Theodore Roosevelt was there too, leaning out of the second-floor window, watching this spectacle from his grandfather's townhouse on Broadway. In Albany, Lincoln rested in the State House, and people came all through the night to lay their eyes on his open coffin. 2 presidents, one former and one future, would rush to Buffalo to join the long lines of mourners, Millard Fillmore and Grover Cleveland. Then the train steamed west, past farmers kneeling in their planting fields, to Cleveland, where a special outdoor pavilion was set up, for no outdoor public building was large enough to accommodate the expected crowds, through which 10,000 mourners passed each hour, braving a cold, steady rain. In all, 150,000 came. Indianapolis followed, on the night run. It was lit up by bonfires, with attentive crowds standing in the rain, mute and still, as the train slowly glided by like a ghost. In Chicago, the hearse was shepherded by 36 young women, dressed in white, representing each state in the restored Union. There, too, were Lincoln's fellow Illinoisans, silent columns of heartbroken colleagues and friends marching lockstep by his side in one subdued final tribute. On May 4, the procession came to an end, across the prairies to Springfield, Lincoln's home. Carried in a magnificent black and silver hearse, Lincoln was then gently lifted into the chamber of the Illinois House of Representatives, where an unknown but ambitious lawyer had gotten his political start and would later warn, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." The official Illinois delegation of mourners, swathed in black, gathered before his home like a Union brigade, preparing its gallant charge for the final funeral run to Oak Ridge Cemetery. In fact, the procession was led by a general, Joseph Hooker. Here, a vault had been cut deep into the green hillside amid evergreens and sprays of hundreds of spring flowers. Through another rain, this one soft, the slow march began, as thousands more followed to watch as Lincoln's casket was laid to rest. The final tribute for Father Abraham was more symbolic, but no less appropriate. Searching for some way to express their grief, countless Americans gravitated to bouquets of flowers, lilies, lilacs, roses, and orange blossoms, anything which was in bloom across the land. Thus was born a new American tradition, laying flowers at a funeral. After the mourning came pageantry, 2 days of mighty national catharsis and unity. On May 22, the emblems of mourning were taken down, as Washington prepared itself for the grand review of the armies of the Republic. For 4 war-filled years, this city had been crowded, but never quite like this. All across town, throngs collected in anticipation, by Willard's and Lafayette Square, the Capitol and the Patent Office, the Treasury and the Canal. In Georgetown, a group of Boston girls, glowing, proud, tearful, excited, and jubilant, assembled. In the nostalgic chamber of the country's mind, their chant upon seeing the gathering troops that day would never be forgotten. "What regiment are you?" they cried, and the roar would come back, "Michigan!" Then once more, "What regiment are you?" And this time came, "Wisconsin!" Again a thundering, "What regiment are you?" And back came the shout, "Iowa!" And on it went. At dawn the next morning, as a soft breeze blew, the American flag was run up the pole of the White House, now at full staff for the first time since Lincoln's death. Miles upon miles of stars and stripes were everywhere, as U.S. Grant took his place, side by side with President Johnson, to watch the march of the triumphant Union armies down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Capitol. This great procession of 150,000 men would take 2 full days, while thousands of school children on holiday lined the avenue, hoisting flags, humming patriotic songs, raining the soldiers' path with a bountiful shower of flowers. Here was the Titanic Armada of the United States, the mightiest concentration of power in history. The first day was dominated by the Army of the Potomac, Washington's own army. This was the machine that had halted Robert E. Lee at Antietam, stymied him on the third day at Gettysburg, chased him down along the horrible and bloodstained path to Appomattox, and subdued him at the McLean House. Brilliantly uniformed, it moved with the clean, disciplined strides mastered on 1,000 marches between the bloodshed of Bull Run and Sailor's Creek. The mechanical precision of the day was interrupted only when General George Custer's horse was startled by a wreath thrown in a road. With his buckskin breeches, trademark red scarf, and mane of long yellow hair flapping in the wind, Custer galloped madly past the reviewing stand, as the crowd gasped, and then with a kick, he wheeled his horse gracefully around and returned to the head of his column. On this day, all was well with the Union. And so, too, the next. At 9 sharp, Sherman's great army took its turn. Their contrast with the troops the day before couldn't have been greater. Where the men of the East were crisp and well-kept, they were sunburned and shaggy and wore loose shirts. and where the Easterners were stocky, sophisticated, mesomorphic, Sherman's men of the West were taller, bonier, with the rough, gaunt look of the frontier. The crowd loved them just the same. They erupted in shouts of, "Hurrah!" Weren't these the men who had rescued Lincoln before the fateful, decisive election of 1864? Weren't these the men who had taken Atlanta and burned Columbia? And the cheers grew even louder at the sight of Sherman himself, with his battered slouch hat in hand, his auburn beard grizzled, his face wrinkled, his popularity now greater than ever. By day's end, at long last, it had come time for closure and moving on, at least for the Union. George Bancroft, the eminent 19th century American historian, told a Massachusetts regiment in 1861, "We have heard much talk about the power of the people. It is left to you to demonstrate that there is in existence a people of the United States." Lincoln was now buried. The North had witnessed an astonishing display of pomp in the Grand Review, and now in the South, however much it may have chafed at the Union festivities, and it did, there remained the task of becoming part of the country again. There was, however, an ironic interlude. After driving rains on May 12 and 13, 1865, one more sizable battle was waged, this time on the banks of the Rio Grande at Palmito Ranch in Texas. Here, where the air is sweet with oranges, lemons, and grapefruit, and lush green fields run with the river, squared off by towering palms, the two armies battled once more, and the last one killed was a Union man, Private John J. Williams of the 34th Indiana. This final skirmish was a resounding Confederate victory. It was of little solace. For the South, theirs would not be an overnight chameleon-like adaptation to the changing world. Good Southerners, then or now, would not as likely make it on Madison Avenue. They were too proud of their eccentricities, of their fanciful customs and ingrained sense of tradition, of their antique etiquette and equally antique honor, of their syrupy voices and refusal to be seduced by the latest fashion and swept away by the latest tide of changing sentiment. But tradition was one thing, the future was another. Now the stars and stripes flew indisputably across the South, not everywhere, but enough places. Richmond and Montgomery, Atlanta and Charleston, Mobile and Tallahassee. And once proud Confederates struggled to reintegrate themselves into the United States, and to once again become, as Robert E. Lee had urged, loyal citizens. Too often uncelebrated by history, and at the time little noticed, it happened. In fits and starts, but it did happen. In a thousand little ways, and in a thousand places, all across the South. "I am a pauper," noted one now destitute Southerner, a friend of Mary Chestnut's. "But," she added stoically, putting her best face on things, "I am smiling and as comfortable as ever." Another, Sam Watkins, a Confederate private who had quietly returned to the family farm in Columbia, Tennessee when the war was all over, to work the fields by day and write his memoirs by night, concluded, "The sun rises over the hills and sets over the mountains. The compass just points up and down, and we can laugh now at the absurd notion of there being a north and a south. We are one and undivided." Not completely, for the hate was still too strong, but it was a start. And people looked for signs of healing. One of the more poignant moments occurred in Richmond late that spring. It was a warm Sunday at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, and an older man, one of the church's many distinguished communicants, who had spent the last 4 years in war, was sitting in his customary pew. With his shoulders rounded, his middle thickened, his hair snow-white and beard gray, as usual, he attracted the attention of the rest of the church. But then so did another parishioner. As the minister, Dr. Charles Minnegerode, was about to administer Holy Communion, a tall, well-dressed black man sitting at the Western Gallery, which was reserved for Negroes, unexpectedly advanced to the communion table. Unexpectedly, because this had never happened here before. Suddenly, the image of Richmond Redux was conjured up, a flashback to pre-war years. Usually whites received communion first, then blacks, a small but strictly adhered to ritual repeated so often that to alter it was unthinkable. This one small act, then, was like a large frontier separating two worlds, the first being that of the antebellum South, the second being that of post-Civil War America. The congregation froze. Those who had been ready to go forward and kneel at the altar rail remained fixed in their pews. Momentarily stunned, Minnegrod himself was clearly embarrassed. The horror and surprise of the congregation were no doubt largely visceral.